Hi, this is Attention Plus Podcast on the Talking Stuff Network. Up next, episode 31, recorded on 2nd of March 2019. And Spotify has launched in India, and I'm happy to say that your favorite podcast is now available there, along with other podcasts like What's Up Geeks, our tech podcast without any tech. But let's get to the main reason why you're here and why you're listening to this, Mr. Arnab Ray. Hey Arnab, what's on your mind?
Well, thank you. Thanks. Is this the 31st or is it the 32nd episode? I keep forgetting.
31st.
Okay. So again, it's always a wonder that we've been going on for 31 weeks now almost, which is, when I started this off, I honestly didn't give, you know, more than 10 weeks to this, but it's continued. I enjoy doing it. The response has been very good. And thank you everybody for listening in. I had other people send me appreciations which are given to them by other people as to, you know, this podcast and how it has become a regular fixture in their lives to listen to about 1 hour of me. And I fully appreciate the privilege. I think time is money. And when you give me time, you're also giving me money in a way. But you can give me money too. And that's the Patreon page. Which would enable you to sign up for a patron of this podcast for a monthly contribution, and the link would be I think in the description for the Patreon.
Yes, and anyway, it's patreon.com/greatbong. So why wait?
Yes, okay. So for this week, I wanted to start off with, of course, the main feature is going to be the continuing aftermath of Pulwama and India's surgical strike 2 or whatever you want to call it. But before we get there, I wanted to spend some time on something which should have buttered up the outrage factory on other weeks. But since this is not a slow news week, I think it's kind of fallen through the cracks. It's kind of not also fallen through the cracks because I've seen some references of it, but I think that on other weeks this would have been bigger news. So as you know, there's this Trevor Noah. I don't know if you've heard this.
India and Pakistan don't go to war, but if they did go to war, it would probably be the most entertaining war of all time. Yeah, because the Indian soldiers would run out on the battlefield and they'd be like, "Time for you to die." It would also be the longest war of all time. Another dance number?
Okay. All right. Coming back to this. So we had Trevor Noah, who's the host of The Daily Show. He's a moderately funny guy, I would say. Again, we have to always understand that they don't necessarily write their lines, that their lines are written by someone. They essentially read it off a teleprompter. So much of what is a television comedy is essentially delivery. It's not really the origin of the lines. There are some exceptions. Some people, notably Jon Stewart, was known to ad-lib a lot of the things, you know, when this was going on. And that's why Jon Stewart is considered to be, the greatest in terms of political comedy. And with the great thing about Jon Stewart was it wasn't just when he was reading off a prepared script. If you've ever seen Jon Stewart appearing on somebody else's show, or in any kind of event, you'll see how good he is in terms of how he can express his opinion. But Trevor Noah, I'll hold my judgment on that, you know, how much of Trevor Noah is funny and how much of Trevor Noah is just writing. But Trevor Noah, after the Pulwama attacks, made a joke about, you know, India and Pakistan going to war, and with India it would essentially be a huge Bollywood dance numbers that their entire military would now start dancing, and this dancing would go on and on and on. And then he made a Indian accent, and this was about 15 seconds of comedy, and then he moved on. Now here's the reason why I even want to talk about this, because first of all, is it funny? I don't know. I mean, it depends on what you consider funny. It's not particularly funny, but it's okay. Again, comedy is always hit or miss. It might not work for me, but it might definitely work. And that's the thing with racial humor, is that racial humor normally works with people who don't belong to the race that is being made fun of. So for me, I think it's fine. If this was something which Trevor Noah had said in 2004 or 2005, I would have just moved past it, because this was par for the course. But here's the problem. The problem is that over the years, the social justice warriors in the US and the politically correct people have said that, no, you can't make jokes about certain, and unfortunately for them, it's not you can't make jokes about identities or communities. I mean, that would be understandable. Of course, if you do that, then ultimately there would be no jokes, because bulk of jokes work on stereotypes. They work on stereotypes of people. They work on either of communities, or they work on stereotypes of the way an individual is supposed to behave. For instance, a stereotype of Kohli is that he always says BCs and MCs. I'm sure he doesn't always do that. But you can always, a Kohli joke can always be made with a BC and MC, because that's how he's stereotyped. I don't think that Suresh Raina has always struggled. Like, if I look through the footage, that he's always been out to a bouncer. That's also not true. But the joke is that Suresh Raina is always out to a bouncer. So, of course, jokes work on stereotypes. And I think that the problem with what social justice warriors have brought us is that they have kind of made a firewall around around comedy, that there are so many things which you cannot do. And if you do, then you're no longer, it's not just a question of offense. You're basically deplatformed at that point of time, depending on how severe it is. And so they have defined a set of communities, a set of identities against whom you cannot make a joke. And if you do, then depending on the ranking of where your target is, the sanctions against you are proportional to that. What I find interesting is that somehow Indians don't make it to that list of communities, even in the US. Even though Trevor Noah repeats day after day that racism has not ended, and only white men want to believe that racism has ended, but apparently it has ended for Indians, for him to be able to make that joke. So I just wonder why it is the case that Indians in the US who, like other international communities, find themselves at the end of xenophobia, are often, I've personally been at the receiving end of racism. Not too much. The reason why I bring it up is because in the conversation of racism, I wouldn't normally bring it up, because I accept that as par for the course. But again, I come from a less snowflakey generation, where I believe that, the world is rough and ugly, and people will make fun of you, whether you're, Indian or you're fat or you're whatever it is, and that you have to grow a thick skin. That's just the way the world is. But we're moving beyond that. So I'm not going to say that, I'm not going to right now comment whether we're moving to a bad place or a better place. But if people want to call this progress, so progress it is. I will live in it. But the problem is, I bring this up consistently in my podcast, is the problem is of one of consistency. The problem is, why does Trevor Noah, and again, this is again not a decision which Trevor Noah himself took. When he was part of it, these scripts are written by somebody else. They're cleared. So there was a committee of people who decided that this kind of racial stereotyping joke would be fine to make. So it was not just an off-the-cuff, he was doing a stand-up routine where he was ad-libbing and something came out, or somebody heckled him in the crowd. So these things have happened. It was a spontaneous reaction from Trevor Noah. No, this was not a spontaneous reaction from Trevor Noah. Possibly Trevor Noah didn't write it himself either. So somebody else wrote it on the show. So I'm curious, and when I say curious, this is me being rhetorical. I know why Indians are not considered to be a protected community. And if you doubt that, then you should see the coverage that India has got after the Pulwama attacks in New York Times and Washington Post. So that should tell you why we are not considered a protected community, and who is considered to be a protected community in this country. Many years ago, in 2007, actually, I had written a blog post which got some kind of virality then, but nothing compared to what happens to people today in terms of virality. But it was about the character of Apu in Simpsons. So there was a Simpsons movie which had come out then. And I had said that, look, the problem with Apu as a racial stereotype is that I understand when people say, but why can't you take a joke? The problem with racial stereotyping of the Apu sort, where, and if, for those of you who don't know Apu of Simpsons, he's essentially a, you know, Apu is named after, you know, Satyajit Ray's Apu. And he's a clerk in a small grocery store called Mini Mart. I've forgotten what the Quick Mart or something.
Quickie Mart.
And he has this line where he says, "Thank you, come again," which is apparently the way all Indians speak. And this "thank you, come again" has become a racial taunt, which has been used against Indians ever since Apu became part of popular culture. It actually found its way into Harold and Kumar. Harold and Kumar actually took on this issue many years ago. This "thank you, come again." And the what I'd written in the post was, it's not a question of do I find it funny. It's a question of the people who find it funny because it deepens their racial mistrust and hatred of Indians. So this is not something which is a joke on an Indian, which is okay. It is a joke on apparently all Indians and the way we are stereotyped as working in small grocery stores, having atrocious accents. And so that is what I found. And it was 2007, so I think the world was progressing. And that which I found to be racist humor. Of course, at that point of time when I said it, a lot of Indians, no doubt, came and told me that, you know, I was seeking attention, that there was nothing wrong with this, that, you know, this was just a joke. Actually, I've seen that these so-called Indians nowadays, unfortunately, some of them are still on my friends list, I've become very social as social justice warrior, but on not on Indians, but on other things. So they're big fans of Trevor Noah. They're big fans of all our politically correct comedians. Unfortunately, I cannot reconcile that with themselves saying that the Apu humor is funny and that it is non-racial. However, everything nowadays, all kinds of any kind of humor is now seen through the lens of gender and diversity, which again, as I said, is okay. But how did this get through? How did we get a dash of 2003 suddenly sitting in 2019? And that, I think, is interesting. It's interesting because it dovetails into the Pulwama aftermath, which is the way Indians are seen in the U.S. And so while in the U.S., comedy is okay as long as it's directed towards, let's say, white old men. I mean, people use this word nowadays. Somehow Indians have somehow been co-opted into that group, that it's perfectly okay. I think what people want to say is that you can make fun of communities which are powerful, communities which have privilege. You cannot make fun of communities which are deemed to not have privilege. At this point of time, the question is, how did Indians get there? I mean, we still are a poor country in terms of the world. Indians in the U.S., if the context was just Indians in the U.S., Indians in the U.S. are racially discriminated against. So why bring up this Bollywood thing? And you're bringing this Bollywood thing to basically trivialize the Indian military. So this is not just also a question of thank you, come again. It's a question of what is the context of this? So why would... why? And by the way, Trevor Noah, even with his so-called progressiveness, would not make a joke on the U.S. military, because they know they will lose advertisers if they do so. So no matter what they might think, they would not dare do this on a television channel. Because as I said, the U.S. is a much more conservative country inherently than India is. In the U.S., you would not have any politician effectively asking the U.S. government to give proof that they have done something. Nobody asked, show us the body of Osama. Nobody said that. Nobody said, show us proof that you didn't do 9/11. Nobody. There were people who felt, there were, you know, nut jobs who felt that the U.S. had done 9/11 on themselves, but they were never given a mainstream platform like the way they are given in India. We have people, mainstream political parties, like number two, number three in the Congress party, which attends a book event which says that 26/11 was caused by RSS. This kind of thing never happens in the U.S. This would be suicide if, let's say, Nancy Pelosi attends a book event where they're where the main contention of the book is that, 9/11 was done by the U.S. government. Even if the U.S. government was George Bush's, Nancy Pelosi would never attend. And that would be the end of Nancy Pelosi if she ever did. So this kind of thing only happens in India. And which gives a segue into the next topic for today, which is the continuing Pulwama aftermath after hashtag surgical strikes too. So I think the facts, I think we all know what's happened, or we have all made up our mind as to what happened really in this post-truth world. Unfortunately, opinions are opinions, and the way we think the universe is more important than the way the universe actually is. So I think all of us have kind of made up our mind. So this is not a question as to what happened in the surgical strikes, but for those Indians, again, I perfectly understand why Pakistan wants to believe that the Indians went there and hit some trees. I think they have to believe that for two reasons. First of all, if they say that the Indians went and hit terrorist installations, that means they have terrorist installations there, which is something which Pakistan denies. So obviously they will never say by logic that India hit something. Second is they will not say that India hit something. This is for a domestic audience, because if they accept that India hit something, then this would seriously weaken their always weak civilian government, that India can come in. That's beyond doubt. And even that has led to their embarrassment, that Indian planes can go into Pakistan territory, not Pakistan-occupied Kashmir, and bomb their installation. So then they have to pretend as if the Indians didn't bomb anything. And that also makes perfect sense, because as a country, in order to build up their morale, they have to believe that Indians came there and bombed some crows and brought down some trees. So that part I totally understand. It's natural, and this is an extension of Baghdad Bob saying that the Iraqi forces are destroying the US military. So I understand that part. What I don't understand, okay, I do understand that part too, is why so many, with respect to political parties in India, media people in the mainstream media, and normal quote-unquote intellectuals who want to doubt that the Indian government did nothing, that this was all for the bombing, they didn't bomb anything, or they bombed a few trees. Now, did they kill 350 people? I don't know. I mean, nobody will know. Could be that there weren't 350 people. Maybe there was 50 people there. Could be. I don't think they'll ever be able to confirm the exact number of bodies unless they go down there and count the number of bodies, which is not going to happen. And right now, as we speak, I had tweeted a statement from the Indian military saying they do have proof that they hit targets there, that they hit buildings. And it's up to the government whether they want to reveal it or not. Now, here's what I find amazing is that should the government put into the public domain what should be classified information based on public perception, based on the fact that they need to because of elections. So this is once again a case where you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. If you decide to make public this footage, what is happening is, in order to convince people, in order to get votes, or in order to convince your political opposition, you are, essentially showing your hand. You are weakening your military posture, which sounds really bad. But on the other hand, if you decide that I'm going to keep national interests upmost and keep political interest on the back burner, then of course you risk Mamata Banerjee and her acolyte saying that nothing like this has happened, we want proof. So this is a game which you cannot win. And unfortunately for a section of the Indian media for whom Modi is the devil reborn, they actually love these kinds of no-win situations. Because whatever happens, they can always play. The wire will always play the other side, no matter what they do. If they decide to come out with the footage, they will say that they are politicizing this whole thing, and that they will then bring on some ex-military guy who will say this is a terrible thing to do in terms of the operational fidelity of future operations. Now that they're giving out these operational details, and then the Rahul Gandhi will run with it. If they don't, if they said, you know what, you know, this kind of information we cannot put in the public domain, then they will say nothing like this happened. So this is the kind of, you know, no-win situation that the media loves to get this government into. Only this government into, by the way. I've never seen this happen with somebody before. So just let's look at, so apparently the narrative now is out. And I you know, from people in think tanks and people who apparently seem to do this 24/7, this is the specialization, that India has lost the war of public perception. Well, I don't know about this. I mean, they could have lost the war of public perception, but it's because you have made them lose the war of public perceptions because you own the platforms. That's why. Let's just deconstruct as to what happened here. Indian military forces get attacked. Okay, they get attacked by a homegrown terrorist who belongs to an organization whose headquarters is in Pakistan.
And they've claimed responsibility.
I have claimed responsibility. So this is all, this fact cannot be doubted. Now, this organization and this person has stayed in Pakistan for decades. Does Pakistan keep people on their soil? Yes. The proof is Osama bin Laden, who Pakistan has steadfastly denied was on an... Think about Osama bin Laden for a second. It's important. When you trust things coming from the Pakistani establishment, this is the level to which they lie. So Osama bin Laden, they were not lying to us. Okay, they were lying to their biggest sponsors and their biggest source of money. That this guy, who definitely has always been the number one enemy of US, he's sitting within to quote an US comedian, within a pizza delivery distance of their military compound. Okay, he's not hiding in a forest somewhere or in a cave in Tora Bora or in Notchwood. He's sitting right outside a military base in Abbottabad. Okay, so he's essentially there in under the protection of the military. The biggest target of the most powerful nation in the world, military nation in the world. He's sitting there. This military nation is paying that military, the Pakistani military, money. And Pakistani military is denying that this guy is there. Not only are they denying that this guy is not there in Pakistan, they're denying the fact that he's 5 miles away. Okay, so this is the level of subterfuge that that country's establishment engages in. To America, which has so much more advanced surveillance equipment, so much more diplomatic traction to fly into Pakistan and just take out an individual. They can do whatever they want. Now, with that, consider India, which does not have that amount of technical prowess, which does not have eyes in the sky, which cannot do any of the things which the US has the technological and the diplomatic muscle to do. How truthful do you think Pakistan is going to be with this country? And yet, sections of our media will believe at face value what the Pakistani establishment is saying, but they will not believe their own country. Even if we don't know the truth, who are you going to believe? Who are you going to go with? Are you going to go with, let's look at something which can never be proved. Were there people inside that compound? We will never be able to conclusively prove this because Pakistan moved the bodies away. Again, if there were 350 bodies away, 350 bodies, maybe it would not be possible. Maybe it would not be possible to move 350 bodies away so fast. But if there were 50 bodies there, if there were 25 bodies there, it's not a big problem for a country to move those bodies somewhere else. Okay, and to clear, there were 4 houses, so clearing the rubble, these are not big houses. So sanitizing that place isn't an infeasibility. Operationally, it can very well be done. And there are very good reasons why Pakistan would want to do so. But again, were there 350 people? We will never know. Was there one person? We possibly will never know. But we definitely have proof that there were buildings which were hit. It was not just a crow and a tree. So at this point of time, sections of the Indian population, including the political establishment, including media figures, choose to believe a country which has lied throughout. Dawood Ibrahim is not there. We had nothing to do with 2611, even when there are satellite calls going to them. So this is a country which is always denied any involvement. And now suddenly we're supposed to believe them and not believe our the prime minister of our own country, not to believe our own political establishment. This dumbfounds me in terms of its audacity. And this is the deep hatred which unfortunately a large section of the population has for our current government. So while there, you can always justifiably call some people bucks, but you can definitely, it also stands to reason that we call out people who have totally gone this mad with hate. They've taken leave of their senses, that they will in general believe what Pakistan has to say as opposed to India. Now, with respect to the foreign media, with respect to the Washington Post and New York Times, I have very little expectation. They have always been, if you historically, they've always been pro-Pakistan with everything. In terms of even before 9/11, it has always been that, always the narrative has been that India is the evil bully and Pakistan is only trying to protect its interests and that India is an occupying force which has occupied Kashmir. So India has lost the moral high ground in the sense that it's perceived to be occupying Kashmir. So any reportage that you read from the Washington Post and the New York Times are already colored by that. So India is shown to be, India is always, they start off with the fact that India is illegally occupying this country. So we are essentially imperialists and ultimately this is an act of, you know, resistance. So that's fine. I mean, again, I'm not in the business of going around and changing, you know, opinions everywhere. If they want to feel that, they're free to feel that. But what about people in this country who know better, who know that that is not the case? But they are motivated, that the hate for Modi, and we'll go into Imran Khan here, has so blinded them that they're willing to believe Imran Khan, okay, over Narendra Modi. So I am, again, as somebody who's, really into popular culture and really into deconstructing, I think the very interesting thing is why are people more likely to believe Imran Khan? It's because Indians love Imran Khan. Sections of India, a huge section of India love Imran Khan. And this is going to be a very specific Bengali, you know, this is only for the Bengali section of my audience, but for those of you who used to listen to Anjan Dutt's Jibonmukhi Gaan, there was a song called Mala, which is even most of Anjan. So again, for those outside Bengal, Anjan Dutt is a singer of, you know, I would say doubtful talent, but he was very popular in our days. Now he makes movies. So most of his music was very popular among college going kids because it was usually about the girl going and marrying a rich man and leaving the poor man behind. That was about the theme of 80% of his songs. And the other 20% of his songs was about the Anglo-Indian community in Kolkata. And about 50% of his songs was aimed at Section B. So he had this song called Mala. So this was again, as typically as Anjan Dutt's songs go, it's about this poor guy, boy who has been left behind by his poor girlfriend who's now become somebody else's rich wife. So this is him singing a sad song. So one of the lines says is that you are so rich, your in-laws are so rich that Imran Khan drinks coffee in their house. Coffee Khan, Imran Khan. That was the line. So Imran Khan as a symbol, and I know I'm being a little frivolous in with this analogy, but Imran Khan as a symbol of aristocracy, as a symbol of, the guy we want to invite into our homes. Like if Imran Khan comes to somebody's home, that is the sign of ultimate privilege. This has been basically ingrained into people of a certain generation, my generation actually, who grew up watching Imran Khan. And the appeal of Imran Khan is that this is where class comes in. With Modi, nobody, you know, the sections of the urban crowd don't feel that Modi is them, that he doesn't reflect them. Unlike Lalu Yadav, who embraced his distinctiveness by basically acting the clown for the pleasure of the aristocracy. And I would consider myself to be the aristocracy. All of us listening to you, you're part of the Indian aristocracy, given the way our population is. That Lalu Yadav was different. He came from a different class. But he was smart enough to not resist it. He appropriated that, which is why people found him endearing. With Modi, there is nothing endearing about Modi. Okay, in terms of there's absolutely nothing endearing about Modi. He wears his chaiwala-ness on his sleeve, and this in a way upsets us. But he wears it in a different way that Lalu Yadav wore his I know how to milk cows thing. And this is why people in a visceral way. Many of our suited booted people love to hate on Modi, because Modi, Amit Shah, the BJP sans the Arun Shuris and the more and Vajpayee is this really hard, this heartland India, which they fear because it's not them invading their life. That is where that fear comes in, that who these people are, they represent the kind of India that sections of, you know, foreign anglicized Indians are not comfortable with. They are more comfortable with Imran Khan. They find the way Imran Khan dresses, you know, minus, of course, the black lentil. And I was going to bring that in. But minus the black lentil.
I'm waiting for that.
Yeah. So Imran Khan represents the kind of leader we want. We want a leader like Manmohan Singh. We want somebody who's like us. And Imran Khan is so much even better than Manmohan Singh, because first of all, he's good looking. Second, he's erudite. He speaks with this clipped Oxford accent, which sends
him. Trophy PM.
Yeah, he sends him into this, you know, orgasmic. Oh my goodness, he's speaking in this. So this is what we want our leaders to be. We want our leaders to be aristocrats, which is why Rahul Gandhi is ultimately so attractive, because Rahul Gandhi is in many ways like Imran Khan. And he's a good-looking guy. I think all of us should acknowledge that. And, you know, Imran Khan talks much better than Rahul Gandhi. Rahul Gandhi cannot go through two sentences without, you know, launching a meme. Imran Khan isn't like that. So Imran Khan is the kind of, is an image, is something that we would love to have as our own prime minister. There is no doubt that Imran Khan is a successful person. Unlike Modi, who you can claim in what has Modi achieved in life. We, the educated middle class, love achievement. We love achievement outside politics. And in that case, yes, Modi is a failure. He has zero achievement outside politics. But Manmohan Singh doesn't. Imran Khan doesn't. Even in the case of Imran Khan, while Manmohan Singh's achievement is at least on paper, or papers that we will never read, with Imran Khan, his achievements are so public. He is a movie star. There are cricketers. Javed Miandad is a great cricketer, I would say, in terms of the number of times India has lost to Pakistan. I would think Javed Miandad has a bigger contribution than Imran Khan. But Javed Miandad is a good cricketer. He's never a movie star. But Imran Khan is that irresistible combination of being a cricketer as well as a movie star and a rock star, all combined into one. And now he is the emperor of Pakistan. Of course, he's not. He's basically a lackey of the military. But we don't like to see him like that. We like to see him as the Imran Khan of the World Cup winning side. Imran Khan coming into bowl. He has that aura. And that aura itself, and I find this amazing, that he represents a country which is unable to say one thing which is true. And yet we will believe that Imran Khan is truthful. And when Imran Khan is making that statement where he's talking about that, you know, war will get us nowhere. No, what he's actually saying is war will get him nowhere. It's not war will get us nowhere. War is, if war breaks out between India and Pakistan, guess what happens in Pakistan? Just look at the pages of history. The civilian government is booted out. This is what happened to Nawaz Sharif during Kargil, and General Musharraf came to power. So what Imran Khan is actually doing is he's not appealing for peace. He's appealing for his own existence. And the Indian media will spin it as if he's appealing for peace and India is the side which is mongering war. Except that it's Pakistan which came and attacked us initially. This is beyond the pale. How, forget things which have happened 10, 20, 30 years ago, but things which have happened 10 hours ago are now totally spun in a way that makes us look bad. We are the ones who have been under attack. We are the ones who flew out and hit did not hit their military installation, did not hit a civilian installation. We went and hit terrorist camp, which apparently does not exist. Okay, so the worst we could have done is we could have hit some trees. Okay, let's assume we went and hit some trees. We were stupid, we went and hit some trees. Let's assume that. And what did Pakistan do? They sent their planes right into India to hit military targets. And guess who? And they couldn't. We got bad luck. Our pilot fell into their territory. Their pilot fell into their territory and got beaten up by their own people because they thought he was Indian. And apparently it's Pakistan which is winning the narrative war here. Can you imagine if this had happened in India? You just turn it all around and an Indian Air Force pilot bails out in India and the Indian people kill their own pilot. This would be a national embarrassment. The politicians in this country would go to town on that. That what is going on? With Pakistan, there's nothing. They're hiding it. Some of the information has come out. But there isn't, nobody's shaming Imran Khan in Pakistan, which is fine, it's their own country, but nobody's shaming Imran Khan for that in this country also. This is the amazing thing. How did we reach here? Yesterday, Sushma Swaraj went to OIC, which is the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which has been historically has always passed resolutions against Kashmir. It is against India. Pakistan has been one of its founding members. This time is the first time, and Pakistan has previously scuttled all attempts by India to be a part of OIC or to even go there. This time, based on the relationship we have created with the Saudis, again, not a great person to create relations with. But again, in the real politics of the world, you have to. Saudis have a lot of money and they have oil, and you cannot not ignore them. You have to deal with them in the same way you have to deal with China. It's not a question of are they good people or are they bad people. It's a question of are you going to deal with them or are you not going to deal with them. And you have to deal with people who have that much of money in terms of military as well as finance. You have to deal with America, you have to deal with China, you have to deal with Saudi Arabia. So people make fun of Modi, that Modi is always going on this foreign trip, is always going on this. He's basically traveling the world on the Indian taxpayers' dime. But this is where the foreign policy needle has moved. Now, here's this guy who's Hindu right-wing, right? You would not expect him to reach out to the hardcore Islamic right-wing of the world, but he has. He's the guy who has. Because he realizes, and I mean his government, this is a collective success, that India is, and in a place which is against India. I'm pretty sure it will still stay against India. But at least a start has been made where even though, and this is a huge diplomatic victory, which again is not being highlighted by anyone, is that Pakistan has withdrawn. They have not sent their rep to OIC, as far as I know, because they protested Sushma Swaraj's presence. They did not before the Pulwama, but after that they did. But yet, unlike previous occasions where Sushma Swaraj would have been disinvited, this time she wasn't.
You kind of answered one of the questions we've got on WhatsApp, but I'll read it out anyway. It says, hi, you mentioned that the OIC invite is a diplomatic win, and I agree. But today they have come out with a strong condemnation of India while nothing was said about Pakistan. So in hindsight, was this a good move?
It is. See, the fact is the OIC is with diplomacy, there is the diplomacy with friends, but there's also the diplomacy with enemies. The long-term objective of diplomacy is to make sure that your enemies will never become your friends, but at least they tolerate you to an extent. So yes, when India goes and speaks there, at least India is moving the needle. And it's never going to be the case that OIC is going to support India over Pakistan. Okay, that's never going to happen. Okay, they are not Sagarika Ghosh, right? So they have a consistent, it's very consistent what they are. So that's never going to happen. But in diplomacy, if you look at what are the greatest diplomatic achievements that countries have achieved, you know, Henry Kissinger opening China to US. Are China and US friends? No, they aren't. China is launching cyber attacks against US all the time. But Henry Kissinger is considered to be a diplomat because he was the first person who was able to open a channel with them. So it's very important. It's very important in terms of diplomacy. It's not the talking to the friends that is an achievement. It's not when Modi goes to the US or when Modi talks to Putin that is worth lauding. So what? They would talk to anybody else. They've always talked to us. But it's when we are allowed a platform at OIC, which is, I mean, you're right. OIC will never support us, but at least they're allowing us the opportunity to be there. Now, we can choose to ignore them, but we can't. A lot of them have a shitload of oil. So in terms of foreign policy, I believe this is a huge win for India, that despite Pakistani objections, that India was at least allowed a platform at OIC. Again, what this means moving forward is even though the OIC might take a stance against India in terms of its official stance, there will be individual countries who India is working with inside OIC, which reflects this weakening. Again, it's not gone. It's not gone to a significant effect, but this weakening of the opposition against India and these people who have always been in the pockets of Pakistan, that they at least are not as sure. That is a diplomatic victory. We are working towards it. This is huge because this is something which wasn't there before, is there now. This is something which we can point to. And on one hand, we are always, you know, the peaceniks say never, no war, no war, no war. Okay, fine. Then where is victory? This is victory. This is victory without a war. It's at least one attempt, at least a minor attempt, to an extent successful, of isolating Pakistan inside the only kind of diplomatic safe zone that they have. Let's accept it. Nobody outside the OIC, you know, they haven't designated Pakistan as a terrorist country, but if you look at the visa restrictions that other people have, you know, it's very obvious that Pakistan comes in for a higher level of scrutiny. It's not that all countries in the world, even when the statements came out, the US was behind India, Australia was behind India. Okay, Pakistan, France behind India, we buy their stuff. So that's okay. So other than Canada, for obvious reasons, there was pretty much the entire diplomatic community was behind India. I just don't see how it became a loss of Indian face.
Right.
And the fact that we were, even after that, that we were not disinvited from OIC is a victory. It's a major victory. The fact that Sushma Swaraj went there, and you know, I believe this was at least in the last 4 years one of the high points of this government, that this government could do this in this time while this thing was going on. And it, you know, Sushma Swaraj, again, she possibly the most popular foreign minister we've ever had, you know, because of her Twitter persona, her own visa mata thing. But this is what makes this ultimately. Is what makes her legacy so unique, that she's a woman. She goes into this uber patriarchal, super, super, like where no social justice warrior will ever go, to that community. She's standing there. She's representing India. And she is criticizing Pakistan for terror in their own backyard, the only remaining backyard that they have. This, to me, is equivalent to 10 strikes behind Pakistan's border. In terms of its significance.
You want to take another question too, sure, while you're at it?
Sure.
So we've got Dan Veggie Patty on Twitter.
Okay.
And he wants to know if about your views on Modi or anyone from the cabinet not addressing the nation during the crisis and, you know, basically being, I guess, going on with party work and whatnot.
So, again, in an ideal situation, I would have expected Modi to come out and address the nation. I would have expected somebody to do it. However, and I expect that to happen because I'm staying in the US. I've seen that to be what the US government does. So much of this is colored by my own experience of having been in the US for a long time. So, but whether it should have been what I liked about the communication was that the first communication was made by the military. It's very important in this because in the US, what happens is that the communication with the civilians is not normally done by the military. The president would do it as the head of the military. In the US, it's that the president, who is the most powerful person, is also the head of the military. So it's convenient. So you can do that. In India, it's the president who is the head of the military, but he is not really the face that Indians expect as the prime minister. And he technically has nothing to do with the military. So that's where it's a little different than US. And US can do that, where the president can be the ultimate spokesperson for the military. He can come out and say, we got bin Laden. Now, that's a political thing also. Nobody in the US called it a political move by Obama, by the way, to come out and say, we got bin Laden. Of course, he got votes for that. Of course, that went into his personal brand. You know, he didn't get bin Laden. And it was not just the achievements of his government. It's been going on under Bush too. But he got the credit for it. So, but again, nobody in the US said that he was playing politics with Obama or with Osama in the way that our media says. But moving on, I think Modi should have addressed the country. I was disappointed that he didn't, but I also understand that he could have taken a stance that all the messaging will be done through the military and not through any kind of politicians, which makes sense because in our country, if Modi comes across as triumphant, that will be a problem domestically. The media will jump on him. The US government does not. Now, Trump does have to deal with some of Modi's problems because it has a media which is pathogenically against him. Obama didn't have that problem. He had a sympathetic media. Similarly, it's the same thing with Modi. He has to be very careful. If he lets the political branch of the government do the messaging, there'll be some guy in BJP who will come and say some. Already this guy said, like Yeduraappa said, like this is the problem when you allow your rank and file to make comments about these kinds of developing situations. So I believe that I would expect the prime minister to come out and say this just for, you know, to know that the prime minister is in charge. But I think it's also fair if they decide to detach from it and let the military do all the communication. Because in India, any kind of action is always spun out as political brinkmanship or political maneuvering. In that case, if it comes from the military, you don't have that anymore.
So that's been our podcast for today. And just to remind you again, there's a Patreon account, which is patreon.com/greatbong. So the best way to say that you like this is to support the podcast, of course. So please go ahead and do that. And also one slightly lesser effective way to show that you care is to write in with your feedback. And you can do that at appodcast@talkingstuff.net. So do send us your questions. And of course, you can also reach us on WhatsApp at 96525-7883. That's 96525-STUFF. Remember to add the country code +91 if you're outside India. We've got some, the comments which come in, and just remember to sign in your name too, because otherwise I won't be able to read out your name. And you could also send in voice messages as well. So that's pretty much it from my end. And thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.